Okay. Well, hello everyone, and thank you for joining the Interoperability Standards Workgroup. I'm Michelle Murray with ONC, filling in for Mike Berry, who's out on leave today. So we're pleased that you could join us. As a reminder, your feedback is welcomed, which can be typed in the chat feature throughout the meeting. Please remember to address everyone rather than only the hosts or panelists in the chat feature. Comments can also be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled for the last 5 minutes of the meeting, so 11:55 Eastern Time. So let's begin with the roll call. First of all, the co-chairs. So Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Erin Malik.
Good morning.
Okay, the rest of the members. Kelly Aldrich.
Hi, everyone.
Hans Butendick. Thomas Cantalina. Christina Caraballo.
Good morning.
Grace Cordovano.
Good morning.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Adi Gunlapalli.
Good morning.
Raj Gavarti.
Good morning.
Jim Jurgis. Ken Kawamoto.
Morning.
Les Leonard. Hung Liu.
We saw Les. Les is on camera.
Good morning.
I see. David McCauley.
Good morning.
Glenn McDonald. Erin Meary. Mark Savage. Michelle Schreiber.
Mark's here.
Sorry, Mark's here. Mark's here now off mute.
Oh, there he is. Okay. Abby Sears. Ram Sharam.
Good morning.
Okay, good. Anyone else that I didn't call or needs to be recognized today? Okay. Thank you, everyone. Now, please join me in welcoming Stephen and Arian for their opening remarks.
Well, thank you, everyone, again, for your time and attention and making the effort to come and join us today. You can see the agenda here. We're going to spend just a few minutes kind of talking about where we are in our work group process. And then we have two presenters coming to speak to us about the HL7 Gender Harmony Project, which was specifically called out by ONC in their publication of the draft V3 as an area that they wanted input on to see whether it made sense for us to evolve some of the standards in earlier versions of USCDI to incorporate the work of Gender Harmony. So we're looking forward to that. We'll then have some time to dive back into our Charge 1A, looking at the new data classes and elements that have been proposed for inclusion in the draft USCDI V3. We've seen in the Google Docs that a number of folks have started to provide some input there. So I hope that you will be prepared to speak to your comments there, and we'll use that as a guide for that discussion. And then, as always, we'll have public comment before the end. Hopefully, members of the public who are joining us will feel free to utilize that opportunity to share any thoughts that they have that they over and above what they might want to put into the chat. So that's our plan for today. Arian, do you want to add anything before we move on?
Nope, seems pretty clear. Let's get into it.
All right, and I see that Hans has joined us just for the minutes, as well as Michelle. So thank you all for that. Good. All right. So let's go to the next slide. And another. There we go. So this is our charge. It's always good to reorient ourselves at the beginning. We have these two charges. Charge one, to look at the draft USCDI V3 as published by ONC and to provide recommendations regarding the new data classes and elements that were proposed. Any adjustments, modifications, clarifications, deletions, et cetera. And then once we manage that work over this month, we will look at level two data classes and elements that were judged by ONC to be ready for potential inclusion in a version of USCDI from a technical and adoption perspective, but that were not proposed for draft B3 and see if there are others that that should be promoted or that we would recommend promotion. So that's what we're going to do here in February and March. We're going to try to wrap up this work by the end of March so that we can present our recommendations to HITECH in mid-April. And then come April, we will turn our focus to our second charge, which is going to be looking at opportunities to update the standards in the ISA. And we'll work on that during April and May so that we can wrap that up and present our recommendations by June to the HITECH. If there are other works that we feel compelled to address here within the work group, we will work with ONC to see if they're and with HITECH leaders to see if there is any additional work for our group to do. But if not, we'll have our work wrapped up before the 4th of July. What's on the next slide? I'm only working on one screen today. Okay, so I'm a little hampered. Okay, good. So let's back it up then. So all of you in your homework were sent links to two Google Docs, which I hope you've had a chance to access. One of them is member recommendations, which is a fully editable doc where we've invited each of you to add information related to data classes, data elements that you feel may warrant some adjustment in from the draft V3. And Grace took the opportunity to put some information in there, and Mark did as well. And we invite others to do so also. What we're going to do is we're going to use those comments as kind of agenda as we go through this. And then the second document, which I had up, but I lost. Actually, it'd be great if you guys had those. Oh, there it is. At the ready, so we could cut over to them on the Zoom if possible, is a document that the ONC had been preparing prior to our meeting. It's called Draft US CDI V3 Data Elements for ISWG Review. And here there are, this is where we have captured the applicable standards that apply to each of the data classes and elements that have been proposed for in the draft V3, as well as some notes. So this digs a little deeper into each of the items, and we will use this. You will see that Al and the team set this up with some additional columns in it. And let me see, are you guys showing that in the Zoom yet? I'm trying to get back and forth here. You are wonderful, I think. Let me see, I have no check. Sorry, no. So whoever's running the Zoom, can you guys cut over to the Google Docs? Is that possible?
Yep.
And yeah, so this was the first one that I mentioned where we've been collecting detailed input from members. And then can you cut to the second one? Okay, and this is the one I was starting to talk about, where each of the draft V3 data classes and elements are listed with some notes from ONC, how they've been approaching this, the applicable standards as listed in the draft V3, and then there are these additional columns added to the right. Now, last year, Hans and other members of our task force did the heavy lifting to help us identify which of the proposed data elements was already represented in a fire implementation guide and sort of what the state of evolution of that work was, as well as within CDA. And it would be wonderful if Hans and or others had the time to do that, or anybody, in fact, who is deeply familiar with the HL7 work in this area. It was very helpful for us to know because it led to us identifying gaps that then HL7, we met with them and they agreed to close those gaps. And that's become part of the process, as you heard last time. This is a document that I believe we are providing comment access for the workgroup members. Can someone from ONC clarify that? think workgroup members can add cell level comments to this, but not actually edit it. That was our plan anyway. People should check that out. But I think we're going to use this to collect additional information as we go along. So, any questions about the two documents that we've put up and made available, has anyone been having trouble accessing them? Okay, good. Katie clarified that members have comment access to the second document and full edit access to the first.
And thank you, Hans, for starting the review.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. And anyone who's willing to work with Hans on that, you'll find working with Hans is a true delight. So I would recommend it to anyone who has an interest.
Plus, as Ricky and I found out, having different interpretations helps figuring out what actually is happening. So
absolutely.
We have multiple eyes on it.
Okay. Arian, do you want to add to that in terms of workgroup planning?
No, I am good. I think we've got a good plan.
All right. Any questions from anyone? I don't see any raised hands. I'm not sure I'm looking in the right place to see them.
They show up nicely in the Zoom when people do raise their hands. So it's pretty obvious.
I'm trying to do this on a laptop and there are just way too many windows open here. All right, good. Okay, well, in that case, Carol and company, would you guys like to introduce yourselves and we'll switch over back to your slides.
Stephen, let me facilitate this section and wonderful. Then you can facilitate the 1A charge. So thanks to Rob and Carol for presenting on gender harmony. I'm just going to give a little bit of a background in this topic area. The HIT Standards Committee back in the day made recommendations that we expand our definition of administrative sex and or gender to be more inclusive and capture both more of the biological variety and the gender self-identity variety that was available as a way of A, providing better care and B, providing better engagement and delivering a more caring healthcare system. Since that, I think at the time we pointed to sort of the emerging vocabulary standard, quasi-standard that Facebook and other social media platforms had put out. I know that Facebook isn't always the best model in many cases for representing some of these concepts, but they at least had had a vocabulary and we were starting to see the emergence of a reasonable vocabulary. Since that time, we've made a huge amount of progress. And so we've invited the Gender Harmony Project here to talk to us about some of the progress that's been made. This is all related to, as Stephen said, our charge for this task force or this work group. And, you know, we should be looking at the presentation here as source material for USCDI V3. I think there's a number of secondary discussion concepts relating to, where and how, what the workflows are in EHRs, how we transition from a primarily administrative concept to, a better vocabulary system. And I know that that Rob and Carol will have a ton to say about both of those subjects. So with that, let's turn it over to Rob and Carol. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. My name is Carol Mackenberg. I am the co-lead of the HL7 Gender Harmony Project. I am, from a HL7 perspective, a co-chair of the Terminology Services Management Group, co-chair of the Vocabulary Workgroup, and I lead a sub task force for HL7 External Terminology engagement and management via the HL7 Terminology Authority. In my copious spare time, my day job, I am the EVP of Client Services for Clinical Architecture. I'm joined today by my colleague, Rob McClure, who I'm going to let him introduce himself this time here. Rob.
That means I have to unmute. So I'm physician informaticist, been involved in the field for quite some time. I focus on terminology, that's to some degree, Carol, and am, like her, involved in a number of senior roles, leadership roles at HL7, including OCAB. I've been the lead in this project and look forward to explaining exactly what the project is proposing.
Great, thanks, Rob. We can go on to the next slide. So we include this very simple in comparison to many of the use cases that we've documented as part of the Gender Harmony project to in a single slide kind of capture how it's not as straightforward as one may think. In this use case, we have a female to male transgender patient presenting for imaging and admit who is anatomically female but undergoing hormone transition. Their gender identity is male and present as such at admitting. Their sex for imaging use is female. Their sex for labs is male or could be more complicated depending on what you're looking to be testing. And their sex for clinical devices and for things like an OR setup could be female. Really just highlighting that the concepts that we've grown accustomed to, such as birth sex and administrative sex and gender identity are not consistently used or understood. Next slide. So just a little bit of background, and I will say we're going to fly through this pretty quickly here so that we have as much time as possible for questions and discussion afterwards. The background on the Vocabulary Working Group project, known as Gender Harmony, began in the spring of 2019. And that was kind of born from a desire just to improve the way we capture sex and gender identity information and a longstanding issue of conflating and the use of those two things as interchangeable. And post a specific request from the CDC to improve the administrative gender value set to include a code for non-binary as it started to begin to be allowed at the state level. It was validated as an informative HL7 specification in January of 2021 and published in August 2021. We describe a logical model for sex and gender identity data representation, which Rob is going to jump into in detail here after I'm done. We meet on an at least weekly basis at 4 o'clock Eastern, and we've provided a link there to the Confluence site, which you've probably already seen. We are extremely proud of and lucky and grateful for the wide participation from a number of people and places, including those that are listed here, external SDOs like DICOM, NCPDP. We've had participation at a government level from the US, the Canadian government, Australian government. Very importantly, community members from the LGBTQIA plus community, EHR participation from Epic and Allscripts, the AMA, ACP, and ACLA, and others. We have listed here a bunch of use cases which have been derived from that direct participation as to things that they're seeing in implementations and in guidance that have gaps with regards to sex and gender. And we encourage anybody who has the time and interest to review those use cases. And there is a way and a template for you to add others. We have just recently published a article in Jamia, which we've also created a link for there. And really, this is our kind of call to action in terms of the time has come in doing, you know, research and across the space. We come across many, many instances of supportive research from other bodies to move this ball forward in terms of better representation and exchange of this information. One particular one that we mentioned here is from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They make evidence-based recommendations on clinical preventive services, and they've recently published their revised approach to addressing sex and gender. They state in that article that disparities in preventive care, such as cancer screening, have been demonstrated for transgender and gender nonconforming people. For example, the USPSTF recommendation statement for breast cancer screening states that, I quote, applies to women age 40 years or older. However, it is unclear how or whether it applies to transgender, gender non-binary, or gender non-conforming persons assigned female sex at birth or intersex individuals with breasts. They're committed to promoting health equity for diverse populations, including based on sex and gender, and ensuring both the specificity and inclusivity of its recommendations. Therefore, they're attempting to advance their methods and language in every step of its recommendation development process. The Gender Harmony Logical Model and the forthcoming cross-paradigm implementation guidance that we're currently working on can support the clear and consistent USPSTF recommendations by distinguishing between sex recorded for administrative purposes, such as birth sex, insurance coverage, et cetera, and sex based on clinical observations and gender identity. Next slide, please. To that end, we provide here a very quick look at the outline of the informative specification that includes a background, current state overview, which is now, a little bit old here as we're in 2022 and it was balloted in January 2021, but a lot of it still does apply. An impact on clinical care, the use of sex and gender and things like quality measurement, reporting and payment for care and data analysis. There's also a detailed description of the model and from some initial implementation guidance. Again, we're gonna be working on improving that and working with each of the HL7 product families to provide specific guidance. For example, how do you represent sex and gender based upon the gender harmony logical model and things like FHIR and V2. And it includes some appendices that had our initial thoughts on the terminology to support the logical model. Which Rob will be jumping into here next. So with that, Rob, the floor is yours.
All right, let's unmuted and get to see the video. Apologies for those of you desiring to be in a warm place near the ocean, because that's where I'm at. I'm actually on holiday. So you hear it in the background. A lot of the middle part of this slide deck, we're gonna have to just go through very quickly because I wanna get the last couple of slides, which were the specific questions about essentially how to apply our model to sex assigned to birth and gender identity. But this is the model. This is the model as described in that informative document. It's also discussed in the Jamie article that's referenced, slide deck back before this one. And go ahead, we're not gonna get into the details on this, but let me just kind of breeze through these next couple of slides, so go ahead. These next slides basically describe, I think, key aspects with regards to the use of these different elements. And we will come back to all of these in the context of the questions that you've asked. And so I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on this. I'd rather spend time on those particular questions. So next slide, we'll just kind of go through these quickly. Those were the first two, gender identity and sex for clinical use, which we'll reference in this. We can come back and talk more about later. Recorded sex and gender is something that we'll talk about in the context of how it's used to represent sex assigned at birth. So we can go ahead and move past this one. The other two elements in the model that we talk about that we won't spend much time on today are very important in the context of interacting with patients. And that's obviously important when they change from the presumption or over the course of time, and that is name to use and pronouns. So they are a part of our model because of how important they are in the context of interacting with patients. Next slide. Again, I don't want to spend a ton of time on these proposed minimum sets. It has come up and we will talk about it in the context of gender identity about how to interpret what we mean by saying a minimum value set. And that means that we would expect a model that uses the gender harmony as its basis. Remember, this is a logical model. They would propose to include a set of codes that are associated with these elements that at a minimum have these values in. In some cases, gender identity specifically, it would be expected that you would have more. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then and sex for clinical use is actually the one element where we would propose that the approach is to restrict the set of allowed values to only those included. Again, we can talk about sex for clinical use. It isn't part of the questions that we were asked to comment on. I'll say it now and I'll say it at the end, in that I think it would be very valuable for sex for clinical use to be something that is included as a part of the USCDI. It is a break from the way we've thought about things in the past, i.e. we've tended to use sex assigned at birth as a proxy for what we're calling sex for clinical use. And we think that's wrong. All right, next slide. Recorded sex and gender. Again, I don't want to spend a ton of time here, so let's go ahead and move on. This speaks to where we stand right now in our project, which is that our first phase was to create that logical model and do the ballot, which we've done. We're now working on phase two of the project, which is to take that logical model and apply it specifically to at least the three main product families of HL7. So that's V2. The CDA-based or V3-based elements that can create the primary focus of implementers of HL7, and that's CDA-based. And in the U.S., it's CCDA, which actually is referenced by a lot of international organizations. So we're focusing on describing that, and then FHIR. And what this means is that we're going to publish what's called a cross-paradigm FHIR IG ballot, where we will speak to how each of those product families should change to align with the approach that we're outlining in our logical model. So we've actually begun with V2, we're farther along with V2. We do have some draft work on that. We're now actually switching gears and focusing on FHIR because we intend to describe the changes that would align with our approach to be incorporated into the next version of FHIR, which is an important target for everybody, R5. That needs to be done in the next month, actually. And so we're working on it very hard. And then this cross-paradigm FHIR IG ballot will build upon that, and its target is for release in September. The R5 ballot will be the next HL7 ballot in May. I encourage everyone to come and participate. We have wide participation, and a very active participation from a number of other SDOs who are looking to align. So we're a crucible of kind of getting something that everybody can use. It won't be limited to HL7, even though that's what our IG will be specifically targeting. And it will cover a lot of use cases, we hope. All right, next slide. So there's this is a slide deck we've used elsewhere. And this was just to clarify that these two things that you've asked us to talk about, that's our alignment with the current USCDI, gender identity and recorded sex and gender. Okay, next. All right, so this is specific to the questions that we've been asked. Gender identity is an alignment with the idea of gender identity. Okay, so I wish I could say we traditionally think of gender identity is pretty consistent with what we call gender identity. I'm not going to go into all of the specifics. I'd encourage you to look at the material in the ballot and the JAMIA paper. One of the important things that we state about gender identity is that it is a value, it's a thing that is described by the patient. So individuals who cannot express gender identities, so far as the questioner would know, they don't have a gender identity. You can't presume a gender identity. You can't presume a gender identity for an infant, for example. I've listed on the right side of the slide the three, the USCDI at the top, what's described there, the HL7 gender harmony, which was earlier in the slide deck, minimum set, and what ISA says. And this was further discussed last month at the working group meeting. The VA had some concerns, US Corps had lodged some concerns because the traditional approach as represented by the ISA and USCDI was to have a whole series of additional genders, those are listed at the bottom there, beyond the minimum set, which is perfectly fine. So one of the clarifications was, yes, you would expect everyone to be able to say someone is a female, someone is a male. That is their chosen gender identity. Their ability, they could choose to say something like non-binary, and you may need to report unknown. But you may choose to do other things, and including one of the ones that's number two of the values that have been in the US set for quite some time now is these transgender specific values. And there's nothing about what our project would say that would preclude including those in a particular implementation or jurisdiction. So if the US determined that it's important for consistency to allow and to actually, let's say, demand that system support the ability to say that someone is a female to male transgender, then they, you know, that's something you could certainly do. The important characteristic here is that, and this actually, I'll say, was something that became more clear more recently than earlier in the work that we were doing. And that is, we at the Gender Harmony Project are not going to provide any guidance, and in fact would say there should not be roll-ups. In other words, you should not presume if that minimum set, female, male, non-binary, unknown, that one of the codes that you add, let's say female to male transgender, should roll up to, I don't know what, male, non-binary, who knows? That's the problem. If an organization has some constraints that they're working under wherein they have to roll things up, then they're on their own to determine based on their input to their process, how they're going to do that. But they are not going to get something from us. And I would caution USCDI or the ISA to do something different from what we're doing, which is to say that these things in fact roll up to something else. Each is distinct. The other thing is that while there's a list and that you see there, it doesn't include Two-Spirit. I think Two-Spirit is a very common gender identity that's used in the indigenous cultures. It's, I think, actually the meaning is somewhat different depending on what culture you're coming from. You may still use that phrase, but it might mean something different. I don't know that means that it's a problem in using it. And in fact, we've already, go ahead to the next slide, through work that I see Claire's been commenting, Claire and a few other folks who are active in our project are also very active in Canada Health InfoWay. They've been working to improve SNOMED. SNOMED had some issues about its approach to the codes that represent gender identity and sex characterizations. And so they've been working to improve those in the context of the Canadian release of SNOMED, with the hope that they will then be promoted into the international core, as you see some examples of this. All right. I'm going to move on. I think I'll let you guys decide if you want to take questions at the end, which is probably best, instead of on gender identity first. So let's go ahead to the other question, which is sex assigned at birth. So it's important to understand that this idea of sex assigned at birth has some fluidity to it, probably even before we started to try and figure out, well, we have this one slot, sometimes two, and it has to meet all of our needs. And so we're going to tend to try and make changes in that idea as to what it means. In other words, I can change my sex assigned at birth as a way of describing something about what's going on with me. I'm not going to speak to whether I think that's the right thing or wrong thing to do, but it's clearly to us true that sex assigned at birth is not gender identity, and it's important to keep it distinct, whatever a sex assigned at birth might be, from gender identity. In addition, sex assigned at birth, because it has some fluidity associated with it, plus it has other, I think, characteristics that make it problematic, it is not a equivalent to what we call a sex for clinical use. And that probably means we need to spend some time on what do we mean by sex for clinical use. We can come to that if we have time, or if you want me to come back and discuss that. But it's not either one of those things, which are one, the gender identity, or two, some and I would say summary characterization of clinical observations for a particular use, which is what we oftentimes need a sex characterization for. So because of that, because it's neither one, neither a gender identity or a sex for clinical use, it is the other thing that we have, which is a wrapper, essentially, this recorded sex or gender that says, hey, there is a sex or gender characterization that is important for a particular context that is neither gender identity or sex for clinical use. Therefore, it's important to keep it, and we're going to call it a type of recorded sex or gender. And what that means is that for many systems, they have that information in their environment already labeled as, for example, a kind of core element of sex assigned at birth. And they may have that a provenance associated with it. It may have come by looking at a document and extracting it from that document. It may have come from the patient just saying, this is my sex assigned at birth. And what our model would want that to be recorded at, as the recorded sex or gender is the value. The description is, where did I get that information from? Because I'm now communicating. Remember, these HL7 models are about communicating information. You can use them as a way of capturing information, but it's really about, hey, I have this information, I'm going to send it someplace else, or I want to tell you about it. And so this is, I'm telling you, I have a recorded sex or gender. The value for that happens to be male. I've gotten this out of a patient EHR record. I got it on this date today. The period that it is valid that I have about that, again, we're probably going to have to make some clarification around this, but the intent was to at least show the date that's on that thing that you're actually kind of describing. So this date would have been February 3rd. I'm talking about myself. And the jurisdiction is for this particular record. And so in this case, it's the jurisdiction of this particular set of data is about the patient record jurisdiction. So it's valid in that environment. That jurisdiction is where it applies. And then this happens to say, well, the thing that we have in our record actually has a LOINC code. It's a sex assigned at birth. And that's our name for the field, the sex assigned at birth. So that source field name is where we capture what it is that's actually in here. Because you would also use a recorded sex or gender to capture administrative sex. And sometimes it's called administrative gender. It could be sex as per on my license, or it could be gender as per a passport, or it could be any other particular thing that would be wrapped with this recorded sex and gender so that it's clear as you exchange it or you store it that it's not gender identity, it's not sex or gender use. I don't know, can you go to the next slide? I don't know where I am. Yeah, so this is kind of the end. This is that link again for our meetings. We encourage people to come and participate. We're working hard to get this IG completed so that we can describe exactly how this is going to apply in FHIR, and, first, so that it can get the changes in, particularly in patient, but also some associated resources in FHIR for R5. And we will be working to make changes in B2 and CDA. So with that, I'll stop and probably over time, but
yeah. Thank you, Rob and Carol. I'm sure there will be a ton of questions, so please raise your hand if you have one. I guess as I've been reviewing the use case information, the very helpful article, and found this presentation to be really clarifying, maybe I can ask the two of you to disambiguate in my head some things that that I'm thinking about maybe incorrectly. So I've always understood the distinction between sex and gender to be a biological versus kind of cultural identity, much more mutable concept. We have a number of places where we assume implicitly and incorrectly that the two are the same, that they are immutable, and that they are implicitly binary. Clearly, at a biological level, the biological sex is mostly but not always binary, and there's a lot of clinical nuance there. I guess where I'm trying to wrap my head around between sex assigned at birth, which isn't quite the biological concept of what and how your chromosomes are configured, the gender identity concept, which I think more naturally fits towards gender identity or self-expression, although I think you're making recommendations that there's a minimum set. And then how we use these fields, and in particular the mapping to administrative sex, as it sort of legacy exists in our EHRs, in our clinical workflows, in our administrative documents, et cetera. And then, I start thinking about how we've used that field in particular in patient matching context, which is the place where I think some of this information is the most sensitive, because we make some incorrect assumptions about how we do matching in clinical workflows, in matching systems. We have a number of places in this country where we assume that sex, which I think we assume in this case is administrative sex, first name, last name, and date of birth, are sufficient fields for driving matching logic. So I wonder if you can comment on how we go from a pretty static and a pretty static set of concepts that don't terribly well match to either biology or self-expression and identity, how those concepts are currently used in interoperability, and how we think about the transition from one to the other. And that's
in five minutes,
exactly. That's a big question. And that's kind of where my head's spinning right now, as I'm thinking about making this transition and not breaking the US healthcare system,
right?
While making the US healthcare system a safer place for people who don't fit neatly into, a binary concept.
Right. Well, we all have that goal. And so the answer is that part of this is to not, our goal was to create a process by which we can kind of transition from the mess that we're in now without forcing us to throw away all the stuff that we currently have. One, And I think we've done that. And a real key component to that is acknowledging the importance of recorded sex and gender as a way of saying, okay, this thing is not gender identity and this thing. And you know, again, understanding sex for clinical use, I think, is really critical to getting the whole picture, because most of us, I think, came into this thinking, oh, okay, well, you know, sex assigned at birth is sex for clinical use, essentially. And we're saying, no, it's not. And so you have to say, well, where am I going to put the right conceptual model that I have around how I know about the presumptions and the documentation of clinical observations that align with a sex characterization? Because that's what it is, right? Sex is a summary characterization that we've just grown used to doing. There are some folks in our community who would rather we not do that anymore. In fact, you know, so you shouldn't be, quote, setting up lab results based on the fact that somebody has a particular sex characterization. Instead, you should be aligning the particular test, if it's necessary, to a specific observation that is either known or presumed, and not to the fact that they're female or male. Same thing with how you set up the OR. You should be doing that based on observations associated with physiology. Now, that being said, obviously that's more work, because what people want is to be able to say, well, I'm just going to look up this code and assume that it's going to give me all the information I want. And most of the times I'm right. And when I'm wrong, I'll just say, I'm sorry, and move on. Well, we're trying to change that approach. So that's part of what's going on that you have to kind of accept. As a way of saying, okay, now we have to go through the process of what do we change in order to make that work. The other thing that I wanted to highlight again is, through the use of this idea of recorded sex and gender, we don't get rid of administrative gender or administrative sex or any of these other, and it's funny, but it's very similar to saying, and the sex that I know is actually recorded on a passport, or the gender that's on a passport, or the sex that's here in a particular place. Those are important in the context of some process that's already baked in. And so we need to support that. But what we need people to understand is that if you exchange information that's used in that way, it can only be used in that context. And don't go and grab that administrative sex and do anything other than what you've decided administrative sex is for. And I would say that over time, maybe some of those will go away and we won't be using that to do those processes anymore, number one. Number two, part of what's been a problem is that the administrative sex may be the only thing that's exchanged. And so people want to use it for everything, including, for example, gender identity. And so we need to break that cycle so that perhaps the data that might be useful in that particular context, so administrative sex is going to be useful for decades, will get cleaner. Did that make sense?
That makes a ton of sense. There was a good set of discussion in the comments, which I think I'll summarize for understanding, which is, you know, the meaning or the intent of sex for clinical use, as far as I've understood and summarized your presentation and the comments, is that sex for clinical use is a context-bound, not even a temporally bound concept, but a concept-bound concept that may even at the same time be different in different concepts, you know, given clinically what's going on. I think in the use case that you mentioned, I may have laboratory values that are sensitive not to the base biology of what chromosomes a person has or the identity that a person identifies with, but you know, more precisely to the hormonal milieu that in which that test is being taken. I may have another context where the clinical context is much more tied to anatomy and biology. Do I have that right?
You do. Maybe. Yep. The person who's got the slides could go all the way back to that use case diagram that we had that kind of aligns with that. But the important, I think, characterization about this is that absolutely our intent is that sex for clinical use can, in fact, support very context-specific exchanges where, you know, the system says, look, my system is set up so that I have to put an M or an F in. And you need to give me the information that I, you know, need in order to be able to set my system up to do that. But maybe someday in the future, it won't say, give me an M or an F. It'll be more like, give me the result of a particular observation that actually is what's critical. Because guess what? There's no system where M or F makes the difference. It's the underlying physiology that's really the issue of interest. But because we've traditionally, as a society, as a species, been using sex characterizations to kind of set up a context for assumptions, we're aligning with that for the time being. And sex for clinical use allows for that. It's basically a restricted set of values that could support sending, yes, this particular patient, when you're doing the imaging setup, is a female. Now, we also support, and actually it's important to understand that one of the required values for sex for clinical use is specified. And we took a long time coming up with that phrase. It may be over time that we will improve upon how what we mean by that phrase, but the phrase basically says, look, there is a specified piece of information or more than one piece of information, observations about this patient that you may need to go and look at in order to be able to make a decision as to how to do your clinical decision-making that happens to be sex-oriented, right? And so while we don't encourage this because we feel it's outing, number one, and it can be misleading, but you could imagine that this patient at a patient level would have a sex for clinical use as specified. And what that's telling the system is you can't assume male, you can't assume female, you need to go and look at observations that are needed for your context in order to make your clinical decision. And we also support in more sophisticated systems, the ability to tie a particular SFCU to a use like for imaging, where in that case, it would be proper to send out. Did that help?
That's incredibly helpful. And so when we think about, and I'm more than happy, a lot of good discussion going on in the chat, but if people want to raise their hand and ask questions, please do. What I'm hearing with regard to USCDI V3 is there's a decision to add gender identity. There's a recommendation from the Gender Harmony Group that gender identity should admit at least a four-value code set, where that code set can and should accommodate additional values, and that there may be, I think the recommendation here is there may be jurisdictional reasons to expand that vocabulary set, and that we should be wary of adding hierarchical code sets or implying that there's a set of hierarchical code sets that apply.
Yes.
There's a proposal to add sex assigned at birth. I think I heard the Gender Harmony, I think I heard this team say, you could, it's not clear what that gets you, and it may end up driving more complexity than it provides value. And maybe I heard that wrong.
What you would hear from us is that we would acknowledge that sex assigned at birth is a piece of data that's captured widely.
Yep.
We would say that the use of sex assigned at birth is so fluid and jurisdictionally driven that, and I think polluted by the fact that we haven't had a good model that covers the breadth of information that we need, that its use its use is cautious. We're saying yes, only if you truly understand its provenance and how you're planning on using it. And honestly, it's a dangerous item to use. And so does it belong in USCDI? I actually don't think it does, other than as a comment to a common, recorded sex and gender kind of thing.
Got it.
Just like administrative gender is. I mean, administrative gender is perhaps even more widely implemented. I can't even tell you what it means. I mean, I know what the text that we use to describe it means. I know people very frequently have common use cases, i.e., I want to know what floor to put the patient on in a hospital. But honestly, I'm not sure that that's more proper and more properly used than the sort of things that you might be able to do with the sex for clinical use. And yet it's there. So we're not saying get rid of it. Yep. We're just saying be cautious about using it.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Thank you. Are there any other questions for the team?
I guess just one comment back to your original question about, you know, supporting legacy data. I mean, part of this is just ensuring that the data that we're capturing is accurate and preventing harmful changes to data that has already been taken. In a article or a study that the VA did, I think it's 2019 or 2020, they looked at the fact that with that singular demographic field of representing both sex and gender, that many transgender, non-gender conforming veterans chose to change their birth sex information to align with their gender identity. Well, why? Because, you know, this was the only way that they felt assured that the staff and providers wouldn't misgender them because of the birth sex field in their records. And it would allow them to provide more respectful, gender consistent pronouns when speaking with them. However, the effect of this was that changing that birth sex field could cause misalignment with natal sex-based clinical reminders, medication dosages, and so on. And so, I mean, what we're recommending is just we need to be much more consistent and separate that information out so that people don't feel the need to go back and change information just so that they can have a respectful interaction with their provider.
That makes a good amount of sense. Mark, you have a question.
Yes, so grateful for this presentation. I just want to close to make a possible connection with the last discussion on sex assigned at birth. It sounds to me like you're also suggesting that sex for clinical use is a way to, adding that is a way to address some of the difficulties with sex assigned at birth and provides more useful information, so that it's an important add to have that either in addition to or in lieu of sex assigned at birth. Am I understanding correctly?
You are understanding correctly. And again, I'd be happy to come back and spend more time talking about what we mean and how we interpret, how we intend sex for clinical use to be used. It is a new idea, but you're exactly right, Mark. It's the idea here is that you could provide, it's not, I'm not, we're not saying necessarily that you would use sex for clinical use to mean this is the sex assigned at birth, although you could certainly use using the model associated with a sex for clinical use, the observations that are associated with why, when you saw the patient, I was a pediatrician, you know, I put on birth certificates, what I presumed the patient's sex was based on a series of observations. So it aligns with that if that's really valuable. But think about it for a second. Why is sex assigned at birth even something we characterize and have in our records? It's almost always because we want to be able to make some assumptions clinically with how to treat the patient. And so, yes, it's probably useful somewhere, somehow, but if you start thinking about where it's used, we probably would agree in saying that we would rather systems use sex for clinical use in all those places.
Right. It doesn't add much over the administrative context where it aligns with documentation and may be used in a matching logic context.
Right.
It doesn't change any of that.
You know, we're very concerned because that's where we get, you know, mishits and outings and all kinds of discomfort for that community when you run alerts off of sex assigned at birth, when what you really should be doing is setting up an SFCU and running them off of those.
Okay. Well, David, you have a question.
Yeah, on the sex for clinical use, since it seems so context dependent, shouldn't it be paired with a context capture as well? How do you know what clinical use it was captured for?
Yeah, and so actually, if you want to go, we actually don't, in this slide deck, have all the elements kind of listed out. You'd have to go to the big slide if you wanted to show the whole model. But this logical model was pretty non-prescriptive with regards to how that sort of stuff would be captured. It had in the logical model, the place where you capture context would be comment. But the intent in our translation of this into FHIR, for example, will be to associate it with context, you know, type of link resource or something else. I think we have to assume that there'll be places where that won't support and you'll just type in something. But yes, the idea is that SFCUs will have a context captured at and when they're recorded. But remember, by including the specified value for the sex value for sex SFCU, that essentially is true for many patients at a patient level. And it only there as a flag. And we're really pushing people to say that context is probably associated with particular uses, right? And so the idea here is that in those situations where clinical assessments are, quote, sex dependent, they should be thinking about what are the actual things that we need to know about the patient, and then looking for those tied to an SFCU if you kind of have the full system up and running.
Yeah, the point seems to be to remind people that there is a context that this should be used for, and it shouldn't be used outside those contexts. And if you don't capture that information, or at least give the option of capturing that information, you're going to create just as many downstream problems as we have from our historical mistakes.
Yeah, I guess the point that I'm just, you know, that's absolutely correct. The only thing that the nuance to that is it's not the context that's really critical, because maybe the fact that you have a, you know, an organ survey associated with an SFCU, and what context would you say that's to be used? We could name a couple, but there's probably a lot of contexts that actually that applies. So what's really critical is, hey, I'm going to do a clinical assessment. I need to do, you know certain things. And this is the big push change associated with the use of SFU. We need to get people to start thinking about not just like, oh, I just do things with females, but I do these decisions associated with knowing this about a female.
Well, what we really ought to be capturing is descriptions of anatomy and hormone receptor levels and endocrine levels, et cetera, if we really want to drive clinical smarts, but I guess that's too far.
Yeah.
Well, that's that. The point is that this gets us at an intermediate step.
Yep.
You can point to F or M associated with an SFCU or specified, but then have a series of, you know, the advantage of SFCU is it supports the idea of pointing to one that is an F and the subset of observations that align with that.
Okay. I'm gonna limit conversation here just in the interest of time, go to Ike, and then I think we should sum up and go to our work group charge 1A, but Ike.
Thank you so much. One point to consider is looking at both physical and behavioral health, where behavioral health may have a different definition needed or required. Because it is certainly clinical, but there may not be the same set of biological requirements or biological factors.
I'm not sure I'm following that exactly, but.
Well, if you're looking at sex or gender for clinical use, that may or may not apply to one's gender identity in terms of what the care is needed. In other words, there's a potential, you know, I don't know the details. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I'm just pondering whether there's a difference in care delivery in that context.
I think the recommendation here is to add gender identity so that we can provide better care to patients by being by calling patients, by treating patients with the pronouns and with the identity that patients wish to be treated as, and make sure that our interactions with people are in alignment with how people wish to be interacted with. So I think that's a clear recommendation, and I'll let the Gender Harmony team tell me if I've got that wrong. A clear recommendation is to add gender identity to USCDI V3 to use at least the four valued code set and contemplate in a more jurisdictional appropriate code set. And then with regard to sex for clinical use, I think these are emerging concepts that we should be in our work group comment, be following closely and make commentary about how we can more align context sensitive care with the concept of hormonal and anatomy specific clinical decision making, or kind of this proxy n-valued string that can be potentially used to provide context-sensitive care. Stephen, and then we'll go on to we'll close this section out and go on to the 1A charge.
Yeah, and I think that my comment may be sort of a segue to that. I want to bring us back to the specific ask that came to us from ONC, came to the public from ONC, and that we invited the Gender Harmony team to help us to address. And that was that we were asked to consider realignment of USCDI V2 data element of sex assigned at birth with that of Gender Harmony's recorded sex or gender. So that's a question that we want to come up with a response to as a work group. And then that would include the vocabulary or value set and definition. And then the second one specifically was regarding gender identity and to consider realignment of the ONC value set with that of the Gender Harmony Project. So I think this has been a very, helpful presentation. I've certainly gained a lot from it. But I want to ask work group members, with regard to those two specific questions that came to us from ONC, does anyone want to sort of take a stand one way or the other? I mean, my personal feeling is that this makes sense. It makes sense to realign USCDI V2 data element, sex assigned at birth, with Gender Harmony's recorded sex or gender. And I think it makes sense to realign gender identity with the definitions being proposed by Gender Harmony. Does anybody on the work group feel differently than that?
Well, I think we should, with regard to sex assigned at birth, I think we should pass through the V2 concepts the same warnings that the Gender Harmony team has given to us, which is make sure when we are recording or defining such concepts that we understand the limitations and the potential benefit as well as the potential harm that sort of aligning an administrative concept with sex assigned at birth may cause. Mark?
So, I don't disagree. I think the alignment is good, and I just wanted to add on that my sense is that the Gender Harmony Project has balanced a lot of complexities, sort of jurisdictional differences, cultural changes, language differences, and this is making sense to me as a good starting point to get in a better direction. And I see one of the comments about sex for clinical use, and I think, yes, that's important for us to keep on the table.
Yep. Yeah, that feels like it should be a recommendation for future work, as opposed to something that we actually know how to implement in context, but it sounds like something that would be a useful add to clinical workflows.
Well, right. It would seem that, you know, with the upcoming FHIR-IG ballot and presumably the opportunity for pilots of the new sex for clinical use data element, that could potentially advance rather quickly through the stages of the ISA process and be ready for future inclusion in USCDI. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be an option today because it hasn't gone through that process.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Well, Rob and Carol, unless there's any questions, additional questions on the table, I just want to, this has been a fantastic presentation. I've personally learned a ton. I know it took a lot of very careful work to get to the point where you're able to deliver clear and crisp recommendations. Just want to thank you for all the work and thank you for the excellent summary and presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank you for the whole team. It's a big group that's working very hard on this project. And as I noted before, if you would like to come back, like me to come back and spend more time going over SFCU, I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
And with that, both of us actually have other tasks. So if you are done with us, we will probably.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Yeah. You're certainly welcome to stay on, but definitely encourage you to go off to do the valuable work that you do. So thank you so much. All right, Stephen, back over to you.
Great. Well, thank you all for participating in that discussion, both in the chat and verbally. We clearly ran over with that, but I think it was a good use of our time. Let's go to the next slide. And again, here, just a reminder of where we are in our journey. I would like to take, I think we have a few minutes before we will shift over to public comment. If we could, so within 1A, just to be clear here, they did ask for specific areas of focus. Any improvements needed to the data classes or elements, including data classes, names and definitions, and representative sample value sets. And I know that this is an area that Clem has a lot of thoughts about, and he is preparing those, and I hope that others will as well. And then, of course, significant barriers to the development, implementation, or use of any of the proposed data elements. So maybe we could just pop over to the Google Doc, with the editable Google Doc, where the members of the work group have had a chance to submit comments. And I think, Grace, you were at the top of that document, as I recall. Would you like to make a comment or discuss what it is that you submitted there regarding patient demographics related person?
Sure, let me pull mine up. So I was looking specifically at related person. And my concern was, as I look at different use cases and circumstances, I felt from the patient and care partner perspective that related person really needs more clarification to ensure that there's no overlap or incorrect overlap with care team members. So the care team members field was for anyone that's directly involved in care, whether or not they're a clinician, including primary care partners of patients. So when we talk about justification for recommendation, are we talking about next of kin and emergency contact? Are we talking about a healthcare proxy or a personal representative? I felt that no matter which way I looked at it, related person really didn't seem to stand well alone without describing the relationship. And there could be challenges if you don't have that relationship. So there is not some, I think there was proxy decision makers at comment level, and then related persons relationship is at level two. So I'm just wondering what the group's thoughts would be. Either is it possible to rename to next of kin or require that the relationship is specified to a company related person?
Anyone want to comment on that?
This is Mark. Just to clarify, I think related persons relationship also was in draft B3, if that helps here.
Steven, this seemed like a
Mark,
really
you're right.
Seems like a really good suggestion.
You're right, Mark.
So that
I missed it.
No, that's great. And we've all been there, Grace. But I think that with the inclusion of related persons relationship, does that satisfy, you know, what the concern that you're raising? They do seem to be well paired.
Yes, absolutely.
Terrific. All right. Well, thanks, Carmela, for jumping in there. I was going to do that, but if you're doing it for us, that's terrific. All right. Well, good. Well, so the work group decision is we like the fact that they're both included, and we're gonna stand by that. We can scroll down. Mark, you were commenting on the same data elements, right?
Yes. And in taking a look at it, I was wondering whether there's significant overlap between related person and the care team members. I started looking into that because I was so delighted that care team members was added in V2, and it seemed to be an inclusive term. So not just the clinical care team, but all the people involved, you know, community members, family members that would be involved in the care of the individual. And so I looked at related person, and it seem to be a subset of that care team data class. I'm guessing that somebody who's thought this through more than I have knows what the distinction is between the two, why this is not an overlap and why it adds something, but I couldn't see it. I added in the member recommendation column the basic definition of the two, and they really did seem to be similar. So at least wanted to flag this for a work group look.
Thank you, Mark. Hans, you have your hand up?
Yes, and I want to build on Mark's comments and echo part of that, is that where in the UCDI it's more encompassing, in FHIR there's a distinction between care team and related person that is not necessarily a subset of, but distinct. And I think that that may need to be clarified in some discussions as well. So I agree there needs to be some follow-up to make sure that the term care team, even though it's the same in UCDI as in FHIR, actually there are other concepts in FHIR that tackle part of that. So I think we need to be aware of that and understand we are both implicated as a result. And I'm not saying that is wrong. It's just to be sure that there's no confusion there.
I think that's a really good point, Hans, and I don't know whether you or perhaps someone from the ONC team could sort of pull forward the specific definitions that are in FHIR or point us to them directly with a link so that we could review those, because it is going to be awkward if USCDI and FHIR are using different terminology to describe these. Just as a response, Mark, I'll just say that I think of care team members as a subset of related persons, as opposed to the other way around. You know, that there are people related to a patient that are not actually part of the care team that are still worth noting. So I think, again, you could define subsets either way. David, your hand's up.
Yeah, just to agree with what you just said, Stephen, it seems to me that the confusion is in the definitions of which is more inclusive, related or care team. And I would, like you, see care team as a more narrow subset, people that are actively involved in the care, whereas related persons may not be actively involved. But it should be clarified one way or the other.
Great. Grace?
I just want to comment, I guess, if it helps with context. For example, somebody that has a chronic illness, a life-altering, life-limiting condition will have that care partner. But someone, let's say, that might be in a motor vehicle accident, generally, well, you need a next of kin. So I think that's really that where kind of the confusion is as to almost the use of that information.
Also, it raises the question of whether there needs to be a defined value set or whether one already exists for related persons. I know when we were working on care team members last year, there were some value sets that were referenced, but here, I'm not sure if anyone's aware. And Hans, thank you for putting those links into the chat. If Carmela, you could just grab those and pop them in the discussion field there, then we'll all have them readily available for reference.
I just added the binding for related person relationships.
Oh, marvelous. Okay. So we can take a look at those. So Mark, I think you were sort of saying, gee, this seems redundant. Are you still feeling that way based on this discussion or not?
It's still a question in my mind. I think I appreciate Hans's point. Related person, if I'm understanding correctly, is an exchange standard, not a terminology standard, but it may explain a part of what's going on. It's my instinct is that this needs a little further looking before knowing what the appropriate conclusion is.
Well, I would suggest that we take as homework a review of these links that Hans has provided and come back next time and revisit this one. We've got a couple minutes. I know we've got a lot to say about disability status. Mark, you want to sort of kick us off in the few minutes we have before public comment?
Yes. And even if you've read the comments that I put there, it even goes beyond disability status. But I'll start there because that was the charge. Got there because the Gravity Project has been looking at exchange standards for source and method of data collection. We've been doing it initially around race and ethnicity, so I provided some detail there. There's a preference for self-reporting, like we've just heard with the presentation from the Gender Harmony Project. And so the source and method and the ability to track changes over time were not a part of the implementation guide at the time. And in my talking with people about EHRs, maybe a deficiency in some EHRs as well, where there seems to be, I'm told, a default to some observed values. Hence our work around race and ethnicity. But for purposes of today, it seems like an equally significant question around disability status, functional status, mental function, where there is, as I'm talking to experts and trying to get myself educated about this, an equally important preference for self-reporting. So the ability to track that, at least, to know whether one is looking at a value that has been observed or a value that has been self-reported without giving preference to one or the other, but at least to track it so that one knows what one is looking at, strikes me as worth discussion here. And I think I lean towards trying to include that as a piece of the terminology standard. What I didn't know is whether that's really my query in the member recommendation, whether that's really a part of a provenance data element that gets connected to the disability, et cetera, data elements, or whether it's actually folded into disability, these three data elements.
Thank you, Mark. All right, so again, we are at time for public comment. We will come back to these items hopefully next time, if we have time. And then we will also invite you to continue to add to this spreadsheet other items for discussion. Should we cut to public comment?
Yes. So if you are on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're connected by phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand. Once called upon, press star six to mute and unmute your line, and please keep your comments to 3 minutes or less. So we'll pause a minute to see if there are any comments. I think I see one.
Oh, good.
I'm trying to find it. It says an attendee. There. Well, it's Claire. Claire, if you're on the phone, you can go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Real quick, this is just one consideration within HL7 and one of the reasons we added the extension functionality to be able to add other things. So my question revolves around if there are Native American reservations that have specific terminology they'd like to use, or if in Hawaii, if they want to use Mahu, or if in the Northern Mariana Islands, they want to use Palo Oana or other indigenous terminologies, will USCDI allow for those to be extended from whatever gender identity set they consider? And if so, have they considered how that might interface with other places that don't have it? Like, would it be filled in as a string for an additional gender identity or something of the sort?
Does anyone feel prepared to respond to Claire's question?
Well, I just want to note that the gender harmony recommendation was to use the four-valued code set as the minimum code set and be inclusive of the ability to send other codes and other coding, and then how, in those cases, how responders accept those codes is clearly a thing that we need to think about from an interoperability perspective. But it feels like, based on the gender harmony recommendations, that responders should be prepared to handle codes that are not in the code set, and you know, maybe remap them to some sensible default. Or handle as text, but that's going to be it. That's going to be an interoperability receiver local decision when they get a code that they don't know how to handle.
It also seems that there's an opportunity to continue to expand the value set as these opportunities are identified. Claire, let me just say thank you so much for joining us today. Your comments in the chat were most helpful. Carmela, you had a comment here. Not rolling up codes. Okay. Any other public comments in the hopper?
I do not see any other comments.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Michelle. So we're going to be getting together and putting together the formal homework ask. But I think, as you've heard, there's some work to be done on determining which of these proposed data elements are covered in US Core and CCDA. There is an open invitation for people to submit comments on both of the Google Docs. We will be focusing next week, continuing our focus on patient demographics with a presentation from the Project USA team at ONC and looking at the question that we've been asked by ONC, that the public has been asked, as to whether the Project USA standards should be adopted as part of USCDI. Any questions or comments from the work group before we close? Arian, back to you.
Thank you. So sounds like we made a ton of progress here. I want to thank the work group, and again, rethink the Gender Harmony team for their presentation.
Mark snuck his hand up there. You want to get the last word in, Mark?
That wasn't my desire.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'm sensing from this that we need some precision around distinguishing exchange standards from terminology standards, which is something I'm getting myself up to speed on with the Gravity Project work. And I'm flagging that for myself for now, for today's discussion, but also going forward.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for your time and attention. We'll see you next week.